Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks for tuning in today. Got a bunch of bad news for you. And at least one good guest. I don't know, man. Maybe my emails smell, so people don't like them. But I got plenty of news. I got a little bit of good news and plenty of bad news. And Matthew Ho is going to be back on the show to talk about Iraq War 3. Do we have a name for this war yet? Iraq War 3? Enduring whatever the crap they named it. What was it? Enduring excuse? Enduring justification? What was it? Something like that, right? Anyway. Hi, chat room guys. There's a bunch of chat room guys over there at scotthorton.org/chat. If you like chatting in chat rooms during radio shows, try it out, man. It's not so bad. Today's show... Man, nice typing. You better look at the keyboard for a second there. Today's show, Matthew Ho. All right. I got a couple more invites out. Plenty of police state news. I got some Israel-Palestine news for you. I got Iraq War. Well, see, you can't just call it Iraq War 3 because it's Syria 2. It's the war against the Islamic State because there's no such thing as Iraq or Syria anymore. How about that? I think that's what we should call it. The war against the Islamic State. And they keep saying it's not Islamic and it's not a state. Well, you know, I don't know. I don't think it's really up to a bunch of Christians to talk, or, you know, pseudo-Christians anyway, to talk about what's Islamic and what's not over there. Let them fight that out. Americans passing judgment only, reinforces their credibility. Give me a break. And then whether they're a state or not, what do you tell me? Baghdad rules Mosul and Tikrit and Fallujah and Raqqa? No. The Islamic State is a state. I mean, they're a really weak, really crappy, landlocked, surrounded by enemies state of fanatics. They're a state. They've got a monopoly on power. And, Mitchell Prothero and Patrick Coburn and Dar Jamil. And I guess especially Prothero has explained on this show from the beginning. They roll into town. They set off a few suicide bombs in important places. Send in some pickup trucks with machine gunners into a few more. And then they say, okay, now who wants their head cut off? All right then, cooperate. And then immediately they turn around, they hire local militias to be their proxies. Welcome to the Islamic State. You are now the local police. Don't cross us or you'll regret it. And so everywhere they go, they turn the locals into their proxies. So they don't need to have 150,000 men. They just announce that, yeah, no, seriously, we can kill you better than you can kill us. So you might as well can't beat them, join them kind of a thing, understand? And then the locals say, hey, yeah, whatever you say, guys. And then they move on to the next town. That's how they've been. So, it's a pretty effective strategy so far. And you know what, for the life of me, I don't know what the Americans are going to do. Were you guys listening closely when Robert Pape was on the show? Here's the thing about Robert Pape. He teaches at the University of Chicago. And when I tried to get a hold of him before, a couple of days before, he said, I can't do it. I'm traveling around. I'm speaking to the Council on Foreign Relations and to the FBI. Well, and we all know what Robert Pape has to say. Stop occupying other people's countries. Occupation causes suicide terrorism. Here are the numbers that show it. That's his only point. Occupation causes suicide terrorism. Stop occupying countries. But what he was really saying when he came on the show was, they're listening to me. They understand. Obama himself understands this. He's not going to make that same mistake again. But isn't he, though? And I agree with Bob Pape that it's up to the local Sunnis. If we back, or never even mind if we back anybody, if Iran sends in all of their militias to try to go to full-scale war against the Islamic State, they might win eventually, but that's going to rally a hell of a lot more people across the region to go and join them. And same thing for Assad, or really anyone on the outside who can take them on. The Kurds, the local Sunni Arabs, they don't want the Kurds occupying their cities and declaring themselves the new power there in Mosul. They're not going to put up with that. So it's up to the Sunni tribes to do it. I think Pape is wrong that we ought to help them do it. I think the best chance that they have is if we leave them alone to do it. But it's going to take forever. Either way, it's going to take forever for Baghdadi and his group to no longer be, the most influential group of Sunni Arab leaders in Western Iraq and Eastern Syria, what we used to call them, in the new Sunnistan, if you want to call it that. And I just can't imagine the empire just sitting here. They're going to have a regime change against Saddam Hussein, who, you know, under Ronald Reagan was the perfect little loyal fascist, mirrored sunglasses, fascist dictator for America. They're going to regime change him based on nothing, but they're going to leave this guy Baghdadi in power, preaching from the balcony for another year. That's what they said. Yeah, at this point, geez, I don't know. We're trying to put the thing together, but it looks like we won't even be trying to move on Mosul for a year. And then they're going to send in the Peshmerga? And they're going to take Mosul, a city of 2 million people. Really? The Peshmerga can hold Kurdish territory. In the full-scale invasion of Iraq, the Americans were able to use them as a proxy to help sack Mosul at the very beginning, but then they had to leave. And that was with full-scale American air power and special forces support on the ground, and as the Iraqi army was abandoning the territory, basically, not fighting for it. So, yeah, the Iraqi army had a lot more going for it than the Islamic State in terms of raw manpower and all that kind of thing. And maybe if the Kurds and American air power really came to Mosul, maybe the Islamic State would just turn and run and turn back into an insurgency rather than, you know, standing out there waving an AK over their head and getting blown away. It would be the smart thing for them to do, I guess. So I shouldn't say, you know, it's impossible for them to take the city, but I don't know, man. Who thinks they're really sending in the Peshmerga to sack Mosul even in a year? I don't know. I may owe Gareth Porter that $10 after all. I could see Robert Pape having reason to believe that people in D.C., just for their own career's sake, they're terrified of sending Americans back over there. But if you listen to, criticism from the right, I wouldn't say anything fringy about it. You know, not just the neocons, but all the other kind of centrist and Republican Party types and all the former generals on TV. And including, in fact, the sitting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have said it's going to take American troops to do this. Now, I reject their premise that America has to do it at all. But if you accept their premise that America must be involved in this thing, that the Islamic State must be smashed by the United States of America, and soon, the only way that's going to happen is by sending the Army and the Marine Corps back in there. So, I don't know. I wish Pape was as non-interventionist as me. Seems willing to settle for air power, but I guess it's better than another full-scale invasion, right? Barely. Not if you're one of the bomb civilians, I guess.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Later on, Matthew Ho is going to be here to talk about the Iraq War. Here in a few minutes, I'm going to talk about Antonio Buehler's case. Did you hear about his big victory? Acquitted! In court here in Austin, Texas, Antonio Buehler of the Peaceful Streets Project. I want to put that off a little bit because I've got an invite out to him, but only by way of Twitter direct message thing, so I don't know. I don't know his email address or phone number. I thought I had it, but I don't. I've interviewed him before, so where the hell is my contact info for him? I don't know. But, we'll get to that in a little while, one way or the other. I know that this is too late and all of that, but at least maybe it'll be different than most of what you heard about this. Eh? I don't know if it'll be valuable to you, but it'll be different than most of what you heard about this. Hillary Clinton, last week, she says, don't you go believe in the myth that businesses and corporations create jobs. Well, that's the dumbest thing anybody ever said, pretty much. However, it was, to be fair to Her Highness, it was a little bit stripped of the context. What she was inartfully saying, and you know, I realize that this happens to me sometimes. I'll be paraphrasing someone else, or I'll be making a piece of an argument, and it occurs to me that, boy, that phrase left hanging out there, if you copied and pasted that out of context, makes me sound really bad. And that can happen to people, you know, when they're talking. She was inartful. What she was really, I don't think she was actually dismissing completely the idea that businesses and corporations create jobs at all. At least that wasn't entirely, you know, what she was saying. What she was saying was you should not believe them when they say that government policy should be bent towards spurring supply. Because supply side economics, trickle down economics, don't really work. And when you give giant tax breaks and subsidies to people who are already rich, that doesn't, I think she even said something along these lines, that doesn't necessarily translate into further investment into, you know, creating new jobs and actual new supply. And I think she's absolutely right about that. In fact, Jeb Bush hit back at her and said, oh yeah, blah, 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 and ignored the real context of it. But it was Jeb Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, that called this Chicago School Milton Friedmanite monetarist supply-sider economics voodoo economics. And the thing of it is this. She's actually, in narrow context, correct. That giving a bunch of free money to rich people doesn't necessarily mean that they are all going to invest it in new factory-building corporations. They might just spend it all on coke and whores. They might spend it all on sports cars and diamonds and vacations and fancy boats. They might decide that right now is not a good climate for investing in, new capital structures and this kind of thing, because we're actually in the middle of liquidating a bunch of those right now. So handing welfare to rich people is not necessarily, or even giving them tax breaks, which I'm for no taxes on anyone ever. So I'm for all tax breaks, don't get me wrong. But giving them a break and or directly subsidizing them, etc., does not necessarily spur investment or much greater investment in supply. And further, as Lou Rockwell points out, this is where the conservatives, and this is, you know, Murray Rothbard, of course, Gabriel Kolko and all that. This is where the conservatives and the liberals came together, led by the Morgan Bank and the people surrounding the Morgan Bank 100 years ago. And that was that the labor unions and the conservative corporations, they were all supply siders. They all took the side of the producers, where in a real free market capitalist system, the consumer is king. But, of course, the left and the right disagreed about, well, who's really the producer? And you hear this kind of thing go on all the time, where liberals, basically, that's how you could define, you could divide left and right this way, in a sense. If you think that it's the workers who do all the producing around here, then more or less you fall on the left. And if you think, no way, that would never happen without us country club rich people to do all the investing and building and hiring in the first place, we're the ones who are the producers, then you're a right winger. But you're all a bunch of fascists. You're all a bunch of statist, corporatist fascists. And in the real free market, the consumer is king. And so she is a complete kook, Hillary Clinton, to even partially believe in any context at all, really, that, you know, business is not where jobs come from, kind of in any sense. Of course, that's where all wealth comes from. All government can do is suck the blood out of people who work hard. They don't work hard. They're job holders, not producers. Of course, from Hillary Clinton's point of view, it's the state that accomplishes everything. But in the market, business produces only what people want. And they don't have the ability to force people to keep paying them anyway. And same thing for the labor market, too. And so anyway, that's the thing of it. A lot of times, especially if you're a liberal and you don't know much about this stuff, you get it confused and you get it all conflated together that on the right, quote unquote, is the free market economists, the classical capitalist economists, the Chicago School or monetarist, Milton Friedman types, or the Austrians. But no, the Austrians are the exact opposite of the Chicago School, which is much closer, really, to the Keynesians and the socialists. The Austrian school is the economic school of the free market. Milton Friedman really is only representing, the Chicago school is only representing the right side of Keynesian thought. Keynes said, listen, government can intervene to spur demand or they can intervene to spur supply. I sort of prefer they intervene to spur demand more most of the time. Along those lines. And what Friedman said was, no, you should spur supply. Government should intervene in the market all the time in order to subsidize rich people so that they'll invest in more supply. And so all it is right socialism, really. See? It's national socialism. And so Hillary Clinton is right to say that you should reject the trickle-down economic theory of the Republicans that say that says taking money out of your pocket and giving it to people who are already billionaires means that they're going to then give it back to you somehow. Okay, so that wasn't that good, but at least it was different than most of what you're hearing about that ridiculous soundbite of hers. I wonder, man, how much boredom we're going to have to suffer through in the next Clinton-Bush campaign. You know, her versus Jeb coming up? Might just die of it. All right, back in a sec.
The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, AIPAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, you know what? I'm going to put off the Bueller thing. I already said he was acquitted, so there's the news. But I want to interview him, give him a little bit more time, see if I can get him on the show. I don't know. Maybe he's busy. That'd be cool to talk to him. And besides, I want to talk about the war anyway. Did you see this Robert Fisk from Monday? Now, I'm sorry I didn't talk about this on the show yesterday. I really should have. but really important here. ISIS attack on Idlib. Is that how you say it? Assad's army leaders slaughtered as jihadists nearly take Syrian provincial capital. His follow-up article from yesterday is less informative, but sets the scene that he was in the Minister of Defense's office when the news came in that the al-Nusra Front, Jabhat al-Nusra, hundreds of them stormed into the provincial capital of Idlib, captured the governor's office, and started beheading Syrian army officers. Fisk writes, by the time government troops recaptured the building, at least 70 soldiers, many senior officers, had been executed, leaving one of the oldest cities in Syria in chaos. And what happened was, I forget exactly the details, but they don't really matter, but it was something like they were taking the city, and then a group showed up and kind of accidentally surprised them and kicked their asses and drove them out of the town. So they were not able to seize the town and hold it. But still, just goes to show. Oh, and this town of Idlib, they said, well, let's see, I'm not the best on Syrian geography and topography here, so let me pull up a map real quick and make sure, because I don't know. I lost the paragraph where he explains. What the hell, man? Oh, God, for Christ's sake. The thing of it is, it's, I'm making a point. The point is, it's halfway between this, that, and the other thing. That's what I'm trying to get at here. Here's the map. I'm pulling it up. Well, that's no good at all. Yeah, I know. It's the worst produced show on the whole damn world. In the whole damn world. On it, too. Idlib is up there. Oh, it's near the coast, is the point. It's up there in the northwest of the country. A few hundred miles north of Damascus, at least. And, well, let me try to find the quote from Fisk's article, because, it was the secondary article, where he's saying, well, no, the road between Homs and Damascus is safe again. Doesn't matter. Point being, things are very precarious over there still. On the Syrian end of this. And I saw people writing about how, hey man, the Islamic State and their attack on Kobani is all just a feint because they're just preparing for the assault on Baghdad. Well, I don't know. They seem to be getting stuff done. And you know, the way Robert Fisk writes about it, and I don't know if he's just being lazy. I don't know. I kind of don't think he is. He's writing as though, come on, ISIS and al-Nusra are all the same damn thing at this point anyway. Even if Baghdadi and Golani don't get along, the vast majority of the al-Nusra front has gone over, I don't know the vast majority, much of the al-Nusra front has gone over to ISIS, and they fight together as much as against each other, apparently. And by the way, you know, I really need to get like the panel discussion going on this show and see what everybody thinks of this. I think now I'm going to have to go ahead and side with Landay that Obama really has decided. And, you know, I think Coburn thinks this too, right? That they've decided that they have to side with Assad. The plan to regime change Assad is over. There are two or three strong indications of this. First of all, as Patrick reported, his sources tell him that America is passing intelligence to Assad through Germany to help him fight, and they're coordinating the fight somewhat through the Germans, even to a minimal extent. That's something. Then you have the fact that the Americans announced that the new force they're training up is not going to be the Free Syrian Army. At least it's going to have a new name. They're going to train it up, and they're going to train it specifically to not take territory, just to hold it. Okay, so in other words, not fight Assad and try to take Damascus. Not even necessarily try to take on ISIS. Just hold what territory? Oh. And then there's this from Monday in Reuters. U.S. sees Syria rebels in political, not military solution, according to the Ashark al-Aswat OSAT newspaper. Hey, I don't know how to say it, as you can tell, and I concede. Some newspaper, Orioner says, U.S., what they want to do here is they do not expect Syrian rebels that they're planning to train to fight the Islamic State militants and also take on Assad's forces at the same time. It sees them as a crucial part of a political solution to end the war. Could it be that they finally, over there in Washington, D.C., started reading Patrick Hoburn for a change? Hey, man, first order business here. If you want to fight ISIS, which maybe is a pretty big assumption, but if you do, it seems like you're going to have to insist on a peace between everybody but ISIS and Assad's government. So then at least he'll be free to fight them. I don't know how the hell that's supposed to work, but, I mean, never even mind the possibility of it. The point is, if that's the plan, that that's what they want to try to do, then that means regime change is off. That means they are, in fact, just allying back with Iran again, like in the days of George W. Bush, fighting with the U.S. Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps as the proxies for the Badr Brigade of the Supreme Iraqi Islamic Council. And I guess the Israelis are just going to have to keep waiting. But what about the Saudis? What about that article in the Wall Street Journal where Obama promised the Saudis that, don't worry, we're still turning against Assad too? It's a big complicated mess. And that must be, you know, what are the Israelis? The Israelis are happy to go back to Assad now? But this is another major bone of contention between Obama and Netanyahu. Or is it still Obama's plan to really support this third force, to try to be some kind of alternative? Here's the thing. For America to support a third force to be an alternative to Assad and ISIS would take $1 zillion and, 10,000 men, 10 years. And this is what the entire occupation of Iraq was about. In fact, you know, the other day, I was listening to some music on random, and it pulled up George Bush's speech from the Council on Foreign Relations from December of 2005, where he's laying out his so-called strategy for victory and going on and on about how democracy is going to guarantee that everything is all right. All we got to do is train up this Iraqi army, and it'll be powerful enough to secure the peace so that the democracy can carry itself out, and it'll be great. And we got this wonderful group of allies in the Dawa Party, the United Iraqi Alliance we're working with here. Yeah. So, the mythology of the moderate rebels, past, present, future, is still something that apparently the policy is still being based around to a great degree. And so, I don't know what that really pretends, except more chaos, failure.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'll tell you what. If I had any money right now, I would be buying silver and bitcoins. I'd be speculating on silver and bitcoins. I don't have any money. That'd be cool, though. That's not official investment advice. Don't sue me. I'm just saying. All right, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, let me talk to you a little bit more about the war in Iraq and Syria here.
Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com reports that the Peshmerga from Iraqi Kurdistan have arrived there in Kobani to help coordinate the fight against ISIS, as at this point ISIS controls half the city. The Peshmerga are seen as unlikely to turn the tide of the fighting, reports Jason Ditz there. Very interesting. The first Peshmerga fighters are arriving in Kobani with 150 troops bringing anti-tank weapons to join other Kurdish fighters. They arrived through Turkey, having been given passage by the Turkish government. Now, the thing of it is, I think the Islamic State fighters already got out of their tanks once America started hitting all their tanks with air power. And there were other reports that said that, well, you know, they're bringing artillery and they're going to help coordinate, but the Peshmerga aren't joining the fight against the Islamic State here. And I guess they have a pass to get back into Turkey if they want. You know, I don't know. I guess the fight for that town rages on. The Americans, supposedly, and I guess the cover story, the official story seems true enough on this, that the Americans want the Turks to fight, and the Turks won't. The Turks hate the YPG and the PKK so much. Doesn't mean that they hate all the Kurds so much. It just means that they hate these Kurdistan Workers Party militias so much that, they'd rather sit back and watch them fight ISIS than help them. And, in fact, I didn't get a chance to read this article yet, but it's Liz Sly at the Washington Post. So I don't like her paper, but I do like her. She does some good writing there. And this is for Turkey and U.S. at odds over Syria. A 60-year alliance shows signs of crumbling. Now, I don't know how overstated that is or not, or whether, I don't know. Didn't it seem for a while that Obama was just sitting back and was basically doing the Turks a favor and saying, yeah, go ahead. And let's all just sit back and wait for Kobani to fall. You know, like maybe it was a quid pro quo with the Turks. Okay, well, you're going to help us fight them in different places in Syria later then, if we're going to let them take this town and beat the YPG now. That's the Kurdistan Workers Party militia now. I don't know, right? It only, the war nerd pointed out that it was only after Panetta called Obama a sissy that he changed his policy there. And after the Kurds, you know, were holding out and making Obama look bad. On the other hand, according to the evil lying propaganda of the enemy that they put out the other day, did you see it? I talked about it on the show yesterday. the British captive who had at least a proverbial gun to his head, so don't hold it against him over there. He gave a report like he's a CNN reporter or whatever, reporting live from Kobani. He's on a rooftop for part of it, out in the open. He says, you can hear there's no big battle going on. There's just a little bit of machine gun fire in the background, mopping up exercises. You say we've been driven, the Islamic State's been driven out of here, but it doesn't look like it to me, etc. He even cites Patrick Coburn in the piece, saying, you know, all these other sources are saying that we're on the run, but Patrick Coburn at the Independent reports that we're not. So, you know, look at me now. How do you like me now? Look, there's Turkey back over my shoulder, he says. And Landay and Coburn both actually wrote up good analysis pieces of that, saying, yeah, it sure looks like the Islamic State does control a pretty good amount of this town still. It's part of the problem of being the emperor and making all these pronouncements like Obama has done about what he's going to accomplish here. He's going to degrade. He's going to destroy. He's going to not help the Kurds in Kobani. Oh, now he is going to help them. But so now can he let Kobani fall after he promised he's going to help them? Or now he's going to have to send in the special forces or more.
send in Blackwater to go and try to hold that town. They'd say the Islamic State is sending reinforcements too. I don't know. The thing about the Islamic State is, I think Prothero is right that these guys are basically a bunch of school shooters, you know? They're a bunch of nuts. And they ain't that smart. They ain't that good at waging war, and they're just too fanatical to be really any good at anything, right? Except the thing is they have an alliance with the former Ba'ath Party of Saddam Hussein and his generals. And so they have, you know, not the best, but they have military expertise to help coordinate. So, but their numbers are low. You know, I don't know. Are they dumb enough? Can they be tricked into just, you know, sending their best fighters all headlong into the chipper shredder there in Kobani and use them up faster than they can recruit new ones? I don't know. But it seems like the Americans keep painting themselves into corners on these things. Because if the Kurds lose Kobani now, then America's lost it, right? And America's politically failed so horribly at getting the Turks to do what they want that they're humiliated. And hey, there's an election coming up, so expect the worst there. ISIS executes dozens, 350 killed across Iraq. This one, ISIS executes 46 surrendered tribal fighters in Iraq, not Iraqi army, tribal fighters in Anbar province. 46 of them rounded up and shot from the Abu Nimr tribe. They were fighting alongside Iraqi government forces. Formerly part of the Sunni Awakening movement. One of the few Sunni tribes that remains on the side of the Iraqi government. Jason Ditz reports there. And, you know, their brutality, Lawrence Wright calls it the strategy of savagery. And it's just a force multiplier that these guys are not going to hold you in a POW camp and maybe trade you later. They're going to brutally murder you. So run. That's the message. Don't stand and fight and take the risk of being caught alive. And so that way they don't need as many soldiers, you know. But it also means that they can get overconfident when they keep winning easy victories because they're not fighting people whose back is to the wall. They're fighting people who've got miles and miles to go to get to the wall, you know. When it comes to going head-to-head with the Badr Brigade and the Mahdi Army over territory that they mean to keep, that's going to be a quite different story, I think, than small expeditionary forces going out to try to hit them into Crete and that kind of stuff, you know? But yeah, it's a big problem that, you know, for the American strategy there, that George Bush didn't quite finish fulfilling the Ayatollah Khomeini and Sistani's will in the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad. They only made it an 85% Shiite city, which means it's still a 15% Sunni city, and mostly in the west and the southwest there, even up to and including the territory between Baghdad and the airport. And some of those southwestern neighborhoods of Baghdad. So, and then, who was it? Ron Holland is this investment advisor type guy. And he wrote a thing saying, are you prepared for the fall of Baghdad? And I've been playing this down because I've been thinking, yeah, right, because that's when the Mahdi army comes out with their power drills and starts murdering everybody, you know? But he was saying, look at the map of where these Sunni neighborhoods are and how close they are to the green zone, and think of how easy it'll be for ISIS to mass forces in those neighborhoods just by walking right in there. They could attack the green zone from not very far away. It's an interesting article we ran at antiwar.com. Let's type in Ron Holland, fall of Baghdad. And anyway, we'll be back after this top of the hour news. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck.
Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up later on, Matthew Ho will be here with American Help. Iraq's Cycle of Violence Spirals is his latest. Eh, it's a couple weeks old, but I don't care. Same difference. Former Marine, former State Department guy, Matthew Ho. For now, let's talk about Israel-Palestine for a minute here, and I got some police state news coming up. Actually, you know what? Let me put off the Israel-Palestine thing and talk about Antonio Bueller. I don't guess I'm going to hear from him. Seems like I guess he must be busy, but Bueller acquitted. Peaceful Streets founder wins another legal battle. And this is from the Austin Chronicle. And so if you're part of the libertarian community, then you're probably pretty familiar with Antonio Bueller. He, I think, also was a former Marine, a veteran of the Iraq War. And he became an activist. He may have already been an activist. I don't know. But anyway, one night a few years ago, he was at the 7-Eleven, and these girls got pulled over for the driver driving drunk. And the cop was manhandling the lady that was sitting in the driver, in the passenger seat, as he was arresting her too. And so Bueller said, "Hey, what the hell are you doing?" Started filming it and, that kind of thing. And then he, you know, quote unquote, I don't know exactly all the different charges, whatever, but he quote unquote resisted arrest, defied their command to put his hands behind his back. He was charged with a misdemeanor, but he took it to trial. And he won. He argued that it wasn't a lawful order, and so he was not bound to obey it. And the jury agreed with him. And in fact, according to the reporting here in the Austin Chronicle, he and his lawyers absolutely made a mockery out of the prosecutors and their witnesses, including their expert witness. Let me see if I can find a paragraph ends with this story here. During cross-examination, Carrillo, who is the state's expert witness, during cross-examination, Carrillo once responded to a hypothetical drafted similarly to the Bueller episode by saying one could charge the officer with assault. Bah, ha, 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 ha. I mean, you know, because there's no law that applies to cops. You can't charge a cop with anything. They can do whatever they want to anyone. But the point being that they were breaking the law. Not only was he not bound to obey the law, but even their own expert witness had to concede that, yeah, actually, initiating unlawful force against someone is a crime. So, the jurors let him go. He won. And now there's more details in that. You can read all about it at the Austin Chronicle. But here's the part that I thought was the most important part of all, everybody. Are you ready? And that is one of the jurors said, "Judge, I want out of here." And why is that? The juror said that he was afraid of retribution. Quote, feared retribution for any decision. And so therefore did not want to be a part of providing a verdict at all. Wow. Now, here's my thing. Bueller and or, I don't know, his friends in the audience, they may be strident, but they are not violent in any way. Peaceful Streets is the name of the project. But I guess I could understand how a juror might be concerned that he doesn't know these people, and they are obviously very committed and very emotional about this, and what if he crosses them? He doesn't know, he's just afraid. I don't know, shrug. I think that's kind of foolish. for a juror to be afraid of Antonio Bueller. I mean, give me a break. Or anyone associated with him. It's silly to me. But beside the point, because here's the point. He's afraid of the police. He's afraid of his sworn protectors. The professionals who exist only to protect his rights. He's afraid if he acquits the accused that the police will then have it in for him. And who knows what they might do to him. And that, I think, first of all, is a little bit more credible fear, don't you? And second of all, it's a little bit surprising, right? I mean, come on, typical newspaper news story. The guy, the juror wanted out and he told the judge he was afraid of what the defendant might do if he found him guilty. That's one thing. Afraid of retribution from the police? That was what he told the judge. I'm afraid of retribution from the police if I find this defendant not guilty. Well, and wouldn't you agree that he's right to be concerned? It would seem to me that he's right to be concerned. Back to the hypothetical. Could a cop be charged? Sorry, I can't say two C words within close proximity to each other without confusing the two, apparently. Could a cop, well, three C words, I'm going to throw me completely for a loop. Could a cop be charged for assault? For arresting someone without reasonable suspicion or probable cause or anything else? Detaining them without reasonable suspicion? Arresting them without probable cause? No, of course not. Never. It's fun to hear the expert witness for the state have to admit that, well, yeah, you know, in theory, that's a crime, yeah. To unlawfully arrest somebody, but anyway, you know, when I was growing up, and I'm from here, and I don't know if you saw the Daily Show last night, but that's right, that those of us who are from here are feeling a little bit overwhelmed with all the immigrants coming to Austin. But when I was a kid, we were basically, the common understanding was the Williamson County sheriffs are the German Nazi Gestapo. And they'll kill you, they'll steal from you, they deal drugs, they murder people, and they are gangsters, and you better stay away from them. Seriously. They hurt kids. They are mean bastards. The Travis County Sheriffs and the APD, the Austin Police Department, they had a little bit better reputation. Mostly their attitude, and again, I'm talking about when I was a kid, a punk-ass kid. Mostly their attitude was they had worse things to do to other people. And they would mostly kind of leave you alone and weren't nearly as bad. But then again, that's just from my neighborhood. I'm sure it's different, you know, depending on exactly where in town you're from, what kind of reputation the APD have. And now I have to admit how many gray hairs I have on my chin and just how old I am now and how long ago that was. Could be that things have really changed since then. I doubt the Williamson County Police, Sheriff's Department or any of those, Cedar Park, Leander Police, are any better. But the APD could well be worse. All right. So, but good for Antonio Bueller. I mean, this guy's fearless, dude. I don't know what exactly is his battlefield experience. Maybe he's one of these guys been shot at so many times that he's just over it, man. You know, I don't know what it is. But he is not afraid of these guys. He follows them around and then screams at them at what bullies they are, what criminals they are. And it's pretty awesome, man. He's won in court a few times. He's got a federal civil rights lawsuit against these guys. He's got more charges that he's standing trial on different false arrests, or, you know, unlawful arrests from different times that he's taken to trial. That's a great libertarian activist right there, man, getting work done. Peaceful Streets Project.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, man. So, let's talk about Israel-Palestine for a minute here. Now, I guess, well, let's start with this. I mentioned this the other day. You guys heard about this. Was the famous Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic. God, where's the link? I got too many links here. Well, anyway, I got links to everybody else talking about it. Point is, Jeffrey Goldberg, a former Israeli prison guard in the occupied territories, now writer at The Atlantic, helped lie into war from the pages of The New Yorker back in 2002 and 3 with all of his bogus stories about weapons of mass destruction and ties to Osama bin Laden. But anyway, so he's basically, you know, Israel's enforcer in the media. Hey, you're not allowed to use that turn of phrase, dude. That's only a thing that anti-Semites say. In fact, he was just getting in trouble for that the other day because he was so wrong that the phrase Judaization of Jerusalem was only a term used by anti-Semites and people opposed to Israel and this and that, when in fact is a term used by the people responsible for the project. You know what we should do? Judaize Jerusalem. And so the other people who were the critics were just referring to that. But meanwhile, Jeffrey Goldberg, like, he's still the prison guard of the American media, you know, the commissar out there with his billy club, you know, tries to, you know, write people out of reasonable discourse. They use this wrong term or that one. And anyway, Obama loves this guy, interviews with him all the time, has him in the Oval Office to do interviews. And he's the guy that I'm always citing. Obama told him back in 2012, yeah, we want to support the rebellion and regime change against Assad in Syria because that would help weaken Iran. You're right, Jeffrey Goldberg. That'd be a great idea to do. Anyway, and you tell Netanyahu, don't worry, if the Iranians make a nuclear bomb, I'll bomb them first. Blah, blah. So anyway, now he's got a new article out. And I think Goldberg, as right-wing and nationalist and pro-Israel as he is, I think it's not even American partisanship on his part. I think it's just some sense of reasonableness in him is looking at Benjamin Netanyahu and his cabinet and their policy, and he's just as frustrated as anybody else. Can't they see that what they're doing is bad for their own goals? That, as the formula is often put it there, as long as the occupation continues anyway, Israel can be Jewish or democratic, but not both. It's already right near a 50-50 split if you count the Arab Israeli citizens and then all the occupied in the Golan Heights, Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. It's almost 50-50, Jews and non-Jews, Christians and Muslims on the other side. And so how are they going to be a Jewish state and a democratic state if they won't give up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem where this Palestinian population lives and let them have their own sovereignty separate from Israel? And so now I'm not saying I'm necessarily for that. Either way, two states or one state, I'm for, you know, peace and property rights for individual human beings over there as best as possible. You know, I don't know. I don't really know which way. I guess a two-state thing would be more likely to have some kind of something like that. But anyway, All I mean to say is that Netanyahu's policy is suicidal from the point of view of right-wing Israeli nationalists like Jeffrey Goldberg. What are you doing? And then the other part of his policy that Jeffrey Goldberg disapproves of so severely is his alienation of the President of the United States. Hey, man, he's the President of the United States. You're just the Prime Minister of Israel. You could try to be polite. You know? And, I mean, they really make no secret whatsoever for their disdain of America's leadership. And Obama's still got, you know, years in power here. So Goldberg, it's not that he prefers America to Israel or Obama to Netanyahu. He's looking at the interests of the Israeli state and saying Netanyahu is undermining them by the way that he is behaving. And part of the story that he wrote was that the people in the White House can't stand Benjamin Netanyahu at all. And, you know, everybody's saying, oh, he called them chicken shit. You know, just like with the Victoria Nuland thing. It's all about the actual bad word. Can you believe someone in the White House used the S word? Well, but why? What were they saying about him? They were saying he wasn't brave enough to take the political stand, to do the right thing, to tell his cabinet to shut up and get in line and we're going to do this and negotiate a peaceful settlement with the Palestinians. John Kerry went over there. I don't think Obama really supported him enough on it in the first place. But John Kerry went over there to try to broker a deal, just like always, just like every president tries and fails to do. And Netanyahu just absolutely stiff-armed him the whole time, announced new settlements every time that they were anywhere close to any sort of breakthrough or on any step of the negotiations. No maps allowed. We're not at that stage yet where anybody's allowed to break out maps. No maps. Put that map away. We're going to announce some new settlements if you don't put that map away. I mean, it's just madness. And what they're, the way that they describe Netanyahu is that he has no vision whatsoever beyond his own political survival this week. And they even say that it's like he has Asperger's syndrome or something where he cannot listen. He cannot be made to understand that he is undermining his own position. You know? But so the point is it's this personal fight. But for me, you know, I like seeing this acrimony between them. I want to see acrimony between these countries. Israel's no friend of the United States of America in any way. All they do is undermine America's position in the entire world. And I'm not saying that, you know, I would prefer to have the American Empire in the Middle East shored up in any sense. But really, a major part of the reason that America is so hell-bent on having a Middle Eastern Empire in the first place, and even to a great degree in the name of oil and in the name of global strategy, is the neoconservatives and their obsession with Israel and their obsession that America must be an engaged military imperial power in that region for all time for Israel's security needs. And if every other American who doesn't care about Israel one way or the other, by their hundreds of millions, disagree, then screw them too. America has to be an empire, or else how can America guarantee Israel's position forever? And that's a big part of it. I'm not saying that it's everything. There's a huge imperial court in Washington, D.C. and around this country that sucks off the empire in a thousand ways, including all the, especially the agencies themselves. But pro-Israel politics have way too much to do with it. I like Sweden has now recognized the state of Palestine. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Yeah, goddamn breaks. I never quite get to finish what I'm saying, but then I'm never quite finished what I'm saying. All right. So I ended there with the new leftist government of Sweden has now recognized Palestine as an independent state. You're going to see more and more of that. The British Parliament voted in a huge majority to do so recently. So, and that's huge. They're the ones who created Israel in the first place. But now, so back to the acrimony here between... and you know what? I don't know. Is it possible? I've seen speculation Obama's going to stop vetoing UN resolutions against Israel and stuff like that. I don't know, man. He's got loyalty to the rest of the Democratic Party, never mind Israel and Netanyahu. But I wanted to remark on this just for a moment here. Naftali Bennett, who is a right-wing nationalist, I think he's more of a secular right-wing nationalist than a religious right-wing nationalist over there. He's the Israeli economy minister. He condemned... He demanded Obama publicly repudiate any criticism of Netanyahu, insisting that Netanyahu is, quote, leader of the Jewish state and the Jewish world, end quote. And then went on to say Obama's going to throw Israel under the bus. Well, what the hell bus is he talking about? Give me a break. I'm so tired of this crap. But anyway, no. The prime minister of the Israeli Knesset is not the leader of... I don't even know if he's really supposedly even the leader of the Jewish state. Much less of all Jews on the planet. Give me a break. Who's buying this crap other than a bunch of Nazis and anti-Semites who like to conflate Judaism with the policy of the right-wing nationalist state of Israel? Who else would claim that? Who else other than Netanyahu's economy minister and a bunch of Nazis would try to conflate the state government, the leaders of the government of Israel, with Judaism and Jews around the world in general? Right, nobody. That's absolutely ridiculous. On the face of it, it's absolutely ridiculous. In fact, the only argument I've ever heard for it is from Nazi types that amounts to, you know, all Jews can hear each other think and they all secretly agree with each other and are all somehow acting in concert against me through my Frankenstein earphone radio. I mean, what are we talking about here? This is ridiculous. Benjamin Netanyahu is a... And of course, then the argument is, no, if you criticize Israel at all, then it's because you're against all Jews. Well, what? Based on your made-up premise, the same person doing the accusing's made-up premise, that the elected government of the Israeli state somehow speaks for all Jewish people? How about I get to speak for all Jewish people, and if anybody disagrees with me, then they're an anti-Semite. How about that? How about anybody who supports the right-wing Likud nationalist government of Israel right now and its coalition partners to the right of it, they must hate Jews because they're trying to get the entire Israeli state destroyed forever over there. Why would you hand the keys to a guy with Asperger's syndrome? You're going to wreck the car. Israel's greatest critics are its best friends, and the people who support the government because they conflate it with the country and the people of Israel, and much less all Jews on earth, they're the ones who are doing the most damage in the first place. And there's nothing that creates anti-Semites more than non-anti-Semites being called anti-Semite over and over again, too. Who the hell ever thought that was a good idea? A lot of people disagree with the policies of the government of the state of Israel because the policies of the state of Israel, the government of Israel, are absolutely corrupt and murderous. They torture children, okay? They are the only ethnic colonial state in progress on the planet right now, to paraphrase the great Max Blumenthal. They're up to no good. And just like America's empire, their little mini American empire over there on the West Bank and in Gaza, and maybe one day on the other side of the Jordan River too, it's murder-suicide. They're killing themselves. So, you know, anyway, why even go on? It's laughable on its face that Netanyahu is, quote, the leader of the Jewish world. Please, less than half of the Jews in the world live in Israel right now. It's what, like 6 million there, 6 million here, and then another quite a few million around the world. I don't know how many more around the world than other places, too. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. What, because Sheldon Adelson owns some casinos and so can afford to bankroll the Israeli right and its partisans here in the U.S.? That doesn't mean a damn thing. Give me a break. And everybody already knows. You don't even have to say it. American Jews are all liberals and support the two-state solution. And they supported the Iraq war like everybody else, but they turned against it first. And in fact, they supported it. I mean, if you have to divide people up in the polls by ethnic groups, and they did, religious groups and whatever. Jews supported the war against Iraq less and turned against it faster than any other supposed so-called, depending on how you categorize it, group in America, too. American Jews, as the saying goes, I forgot the saying. It's something like they make money like country club Republicans, but they vote like Puerto Ricans, right? I didn't make that up. They like paying high taxes. They think it's the right thing to do to pay for the school system and all that kind of stuff. They're Democrats, American Jews, in huge numbers, by huge majorities. And they support the two-state solution over there. And do not approve of Benjamin Netanyahu. And I mean in general. I'm not talking about over at the Mondo Weiss blog. I'm talking about in general. You can look at the polls. I don't have them in front of me, but I've seen them before. Netanyahu is the leader of the Jewish world. What a joke. I wonder how much pushback there's been. I haven't really Googled around until this very moment to see if that's making news and if people are trying to dispute that. There certainly is no single religious authority for Jews in the world. Why in the hell would Benjamin Netanyahu be their leader? That's funny, dude. Well, let me put it in the news here. I don't see much reporting on it there. All right, let me see here. There was one more. Oh, man, I'm sorry for giving this the short shrift. I didn't mean to. Egypt, junta, demolishes Sinai homes for buffer zone. You may have seen the pictures of this online going around where the Egyptian, junta, military coup d'etat dictatorship backed by the U.S. and Israel that canceled the elections of 2011 with the point of their guns, murdered more than 1,000 people, more than a couple of thousand people doing so. They are now clamping down on the poor prisoners of the Gaza Strip, worse even than under Hosni Mubarak. And they're completely demolishing all of the build-up buildings in the neighborhood right there adjacent to the Rafah crossing so as to better clamp down on smuggling, food to hungry people.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Sorry, I was busy tweeting.
tweeting here and back and forth and over there. And God dang, here in a little while we'll have Matthew Ho on the show. Talk about the war in Iraq. Plenty of bad news there. Now to the police state news. A new one at The Intercept. This one is by Cora Courier. Secret manuals show the spyware sold to despots and cops worldwide. When Apple and Google unveiled new encryption schemes last month, law enforcement officials complained, that they wouldn't be able to unlock evidence on criminals' digital devices. What they didn't say is that there are already methods to bypass encryption, thanks to off-the-shelf digital implants readily available to the smallest national agencies and the largest city police forces. Easy-to-use software that takes over and monitors digital devices in real time, according to documents obtained by The Intercept. "We're publishing in full," they write, "for the first time, manuals explaining the prominent commercial implant software remote control system," that's in quotes there, "manufactured by the Italian company Hacking Team. Despite FBI Director James Comey's dire warnings about the impact of widespread data scrambling, quote, criminals and terrorists would like nothing more," he declared. Hacking Team explicitly promises on its website that its software can, quote, defeat encryption. The manuals describe Hacking Team software for government technicians and analysts, showing how it can activate cameras, exfiltrate emails, record Skype calls, log typing, and collect passwords on targeted devices. They also catalog a range of pre-bottled techniques for infecting those devices using Wi-Fi networks, USB sticks, streaming video, and email attachments to deliver viral installers. With a few clicks of a mouse, even a lightly trained technician can build up a software agent that can infect and monitor a device, then upload captured data at unobtrusive times using a stealthy network of proxy servers, all without leaving a trace. That, at least, is what Hacking Team's manuals claim as the company tries to distinguish its offerings in the global marketplace for government hacking software. Hacking Team's efforts include a visible push into the U.S. through remote control systems. It is sold around the... Yeah, that always throws me off when a sentence ends with a initial, you know, with a period. And it seems like the convention should be two periods so that I'm certain your sentence is over. Although the capital T in though could have been a clue to me. Hacking Team's efforts include a visible push into the U.S. Though remote control system is sold around the world, suspected clients include small governments in dozens of countries, from Ethiopia to Kazakhstan to Saudi Arabia to Mexico to Oman. The company keeps one of its three listed worldwide offices in Annapolis, Maryland, on the edge of the federal intelligence and law enforcement cluster around the nation's capital, has sent representatives to American Homeland Security trade shows and conferences, and where it has led training seminars like cyber intelligence solutions to data encryption for police, and has even taken an investment from a firm headed by America's former ambassador to Italy. The United States is also, according to two separate research teams, far and away Hacking Team's top nexus for servers, hosting upwards of 100 such systems, roughly a fifth of all its servers globally. The company has made at least some sales to American entities, according to comments of its outspoken co-founder and CEO, David Vincenzetti, made in La Espresso in 2011. Quote, "We sell remote control system to institutions in more than 40 countries on five continents," he told the Italian news magazine. "All of Europe, but also the Middle East, Asia, United States of America." In the English language press, where Hacking Team has been more circumspect about its client list, Vincenzetti's La Espresso comments about selling implants to U.S. institutions seems to have fallen through the cracks. Asked about them, Hacking Team spokesman Eric Rabe, told The Intercept, "We do not identify either our clients or their locations."
whatever the extent of its U.S. sales, Hacking Team's manuals deserve an audience in America and beyond. This summer, researchers at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs, including the co-author of this piece, published excerpts of the manuals and technical descriptions of Hacking Team's capabilities. Publishing the manuals in their entirety here will give the public a better understanding of the sophistication of these relatively low-cost and increasingly prevalent surveillance tools. That sort of understanding is particularly important at a time when digital monitoring has spread from large federal agencies to local police departments, and as more national governments gain the once rarefied ability to deploy digital implants across borders. Turnkey solutions like RCS effectively multiply the online threats faced by activists, dissidents, lawyers, businessmen, journalists, and any number of other computer users. And hell, this thing goes on, and I'm not going to read any more, but that's a pretty damn good... Boy, it really goes on. Well, no, here's the manual down below. The article's not that much longer. That's a good ad for it, right? Firstlook.org, secret manuals show the spyware sold to despots and cops worldwide. And I want to break off from that to get to this other article here along those same lines from The Guardian today. FBI demands new powers to hack into computers and carry out surveillance. I swear, I sent out some invites to the FFF and a couple other people to try to talk about this. I should have just called Marcy Wheeler, man. She knows everything about everything. Anyway, I guess it's not too late. Maybe I'll call her in a minute, see if I can get her to talk about it. So what it is they're changing a rule, a guideline at the Department of Justice to allow the FBI. You know how it is with these guys. You change a and to a could be or something, and blam, all of a sudden, shall takes on a whole new meaning. And what it is, well, here's what it says. I'm trying to find the paragraph where they really explain it because it's complicated. All right, so the proposed operating changes related to Rule 41 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, the terms under which the FBI is allowed to conduct searches under court-approved warrants. Under existing wording, warrants have to be highly focused on specific locations where suspected criminal activity is occurring and approved by judges located in that same district. Yeah, because that's what the Bill of Rights says. But under the proposed amendment, a judge can issue a warrant that would allow the FBI to hack into any computer, no matter where it is located. The change is designed specifically to help federal investigators carry out surveillance on computers that have been anonymized, that is, their location has been hidden using tools such as Tor. The amendment inserts a clause that would allow a judge to issue warrants to gain, quote, remote access to computers, quote, located within or outside that district. That's all they got to do. Or outside. They add the words or outside to a rule change in the regulations, in the guidelines. And then it means, oh, they can do whatever they want. Were the amendment to be granted to the regulatory committee, the FBI would have the green light to unleash its capabilities, known as network investigative techniques, on computers across America and beyond. The technique involves clandestinely installing malicious software onto a computer that in turn allows federal agents effectively to control the machine, downloading all its digital contents, switching on its camera and microphone, on or off, and even taking over other computers in its network. This is an extremely invasive technique, this and that. So here we're talking about the secret manual from this company that provides this software to law enforcement agencies like the FBI. And here they are trying to just propose an amendment to a guideline that will allow them then to get away with blue bloody murder. To erase the Fourth Amendment's requirement that warrants be specific. Another loophole around Amendment 4 here. It's in The Guardian today. FBI demands new powers.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West while he learns new things about the world and himself. Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal as we knew it is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. Looks like the feds have raided a bunch of pot operations in Colorado, according to this reporting. It's not really clear whether these were licensed under the state rules and the feds are saying they don't care about that, or these are black market distributors who thought they could get away with it under the new relaxed policies, or what exactly. Well, here's an update. DEA agent familiar with Tuesday's raids in Denver told the Huffington Post the alleged misdeeds of the targeted grow operations fell within the Justice Department's 2013 enforcement priorities, as well as constituting violations of state marijuana laws. Yeah, I don't know. Yep. It's not safe to go outside as long as the United States is occupying America. We gotta get them out of here, man. Alright, and man, speaking of which, and of course, you know, it's the locals all carrying this out, don't get me wrong, but a big part of this, of course, is federal policy, federal money. This is by Dara Lind at Vox.com. I'm glad to see this getting more, you know, mainstream attention. I guess Ferguson and the killing of Mike Brown and then the government's clampdown, insane Nazi response to the protests over the killing of Mike Brown has helped really bring this to the attention of a lot of people. So Vox.com, that's as mainstream center left as you can get right there. Cops do 20,000 no-knock raids a year. 20,000. Maybe I already knew that, or I forgot, or thought it was more or less, or I don't know, but that is so many. But you know what I want to know is, how many is that divided by 365 days in a year? And the answer to that is 54.7. We'll round up. 55 SWAT raids a day in the United States of America. If that was going on in any other country, it would be the mark of a fascist, Nazi, totalitarian dictatorship, especially with the whole middle of the night thing. And yeah, in many cases, some of these people, you know, they're never seen again. Go off to prison on some bogus drug charge or some trumped up charge and lucky to see the light of day. Nobody cares when a prisoner gets killed though, right? He's a prisoner. Must have deserved to be in there for something, right? Anyway. So the article starts out with two cases from here in Texas. Guy and McGee. Both of them killed a cop who was kicking in their door in the middle of the night. One was indicted and charged with capital murder. Death penalty charge for killing a cop. The other was no-billed by the grand jury, who said, hey, man, he thought he was defending his family from an intruder, you know? And as they explained the difference between the two, there were a few differences. One of them probably had even more reason to believe that his house was being invaded by criminals. They're coming in his window. And I think he's also the guy that had the pregnant wife who he was defending. He was the one who was indicted. He was black. The white guy was the one who actually had some weed. Who cares? A few pounds, they say, of plants in his house. But he was the one that was no-billed. I'm not saying he shouldn't have been no-billed. I'm just saying, those are the breaks when you're born with darker skin in America and you're going up against the grand jury. And also, you know, what does the DA think?
Hey, I'm a white guy. If I ever have to defend my own life, I hope the DA tells the grand jury that, hey, it's a clear-cut case of self-defense. But I don't think that a black guy in the same position ought to be screwed any worse than me. That doesn't quite seem fair. I'm not asking for equal opportunity persecution. But I'm just saying, is there any reason to believe that this guy really knew or even had a real reason to believe that it was police breaking into his house in the middle of the night? It seems like, well, supposedly under the American system, the burden would be on them. But anyway, so then they go on, beyond the disparity in black and white here. they talk about a little bit of the history. And, you know, I didn't even get this far. Do they talk about Nelson Rockefeller? I guess not. Nelson Rockefeller, he was the second oldest grandson of John D. Rockefeller. And he became the governor of New York and eventually vice president. And they still in New York to this day call them the Rockefeller drug laws, where they gave incredibly stiff sentences for the most minor possession charges, never even mind dealing in them or anything. And part of that same crackdown incorporated the no-knock raid. And the theory was that, oh, I don't know, a handful of times, the cops were knocking on the door. And before they could kick it in, the terrible druggy criminal would go and flush the drugs down the toilet, depriving the cops of their evidence and their conviction. Well, so there's only one solution. The cops shouldn't have to knock anymore. They should be able to dress up like the Delta Force, anti-terrorist, special forces, army killers, and come into your house at 4 o'clock in the morning. In full battle gear with machine guns and black masks. In complete surprise, invoking the Powell Doctrine of overwhelming force instead of the peace officer's doctrine of the absolute minimum amount of force necessary to protect the rights of the suspect. Ha! It just sounds like a damned farce coming out of my mouth when I say it that way, right? Like that's what the cop's job is? To protect the rights of suspects? Who believes that mythology anymore? But anyway, so that was Rockefeller in New York led the way on this, and the rest of the country followed. And of course, the cops love it because it's a lot of fun for them. They're all a bunch of steroid-pumping meathead idiots. They like terrorizing people. They're not brave enough to go be in the army and, you know, shoot at anybody who could shoot back at them. Not in any regular way they got to deal with. But kicking in doors to their next-door neighbors, well, that's just a barrel of monkeys, man. And it's funny, because I remember when they first started with these SWAT teams even thinking about, so what do these guys do? They just sit around at the headquarters in their full battle gear all day just waiting for a crisis bad enough to happen for them to have to go out? And what if that doesn't happen for weeks at a time? It's pretty obvious to see these guys are going to find things to do. And it wasn't, you know, very long at all after that. I saw my first just regular cop out driving around in his Crown Victoria, only he's wearing all black SWAT fatigues. He doesn't have the full armor on, but it's in the trunk. He is the SWAT team, and he's out just patrolling around. These guys are, you know, just like any government program, they're a self-licking ice cream cone. They're their own justification. Try to take a general's base away and watch him come up with a new reason why you need to have it. It's the very same with them. You're going to have a SWAT team sitting around all day? Hell no. They're going to go find doors to kick in. And that's why you read about SWAT teams raiding barbershops over license inspections and IRS coming into businesses full of, you know, middle-aged secretary ladies, moms, and regular, you know, where the worst criminal activity suspected is on a piece of paper.
And you see this going on all the time. 55 SWAT raids a day. Read all about it at Vox.com. People cry, no, you can't do this. This is America, but it's not. It's the homeland now. You already lost this fight. God, look at the pictures of these goons, too. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all. So, yeah, that really is a good one. I sent an invite to this person to try to get him on the show today. To no avail. But I do hope you'll take a look at it. I guess it's the best thing I've ever read or seen at Vox.com. Cops do 20,000 no-knock raids a year. Civilians often pay the price when they go wrong. There was one guy that, Radley Balco, who's now over there at the Washington Post, kind of intervened with his pen and got the guy, saved him from death row. Guy was sentenced to death for shooting a cop that raided his house in the middle of the night. And he didn't know. The guy's name was Rory something. And he had a credible case. He didn't know it was a cop. And I think in that case, well, I don't know if in that case, I'm pretty sure. The government's argument was, it doesn't matter if you knew it was a cop or not. Well, of course it matters. And of course, the word is out. I mean, regular people know that criminals know that that's the best way to do a home invasion is scream police, police, police as you break in the damn door and throw everybody off for an instant so they don't go grab their gun. That's happened plenty of times, that it's a matter of, you know, urban myth or whatever. Certainly the criminals, any brave enough to do a home invasion, would be smart enough to think that that would be the thing to do. And, you know, I'll go back again and again to the Waco massacre and the example set there where, it's Victor Oboisky is his name, is the big fat steroid-pumping meathead pig from the ATF testifying before the Congress on his justification for doing what they did to those poor people. And what he says is, the days of a couple of cops in three-piece suits walking up to and knocking on a door to serve a warrant of any kind is over. Because we stand between the David Koreshes of the world and everybody here, which is, of course, the government, not the civilians of the country, but the government. We stand between David Koresh and all the David Koreshes out there, and you, Congressman. And that's why it has to be this way. But what a damn lie is that? David Koresh wasn't even David Koresh, much less everybody else. It's a matter of fact that David Koresh's weapons arsenal was just his inventory for his gun business. And in fact, Paul Fatta, who actually ran the gun business there, not Koresh, I mean, he was involved in it, but Paul Fatta left the morning of the raid with 90% of their guns, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rifles. I mean, I don't know, high hundreds of rifles. You know, a camper shell on the back of his dually pickup truck, full, plus towing a U-Haul trailer, full of rifles, to go sell them at the gun show on the open market, perfectly legally. In fact, when he heard about the raid, Paul Fatta called and said, I'm Paul Fatta, I'm the guy with the guns, are you looking for me? I'm down here in Austin at the gun show. And they said, no, we're not looking for you. All right. He ended up going to prison for conspiracy anyway, even though he wasn't even there that day and didn't even do anything. So David Koresh, you know, the theory, the myth that you were supposed to believe, that those congressmen were supposed to believe, was that Koresh was amassing all these weapons, including fully automatic weapons, which was a lie, and that he was amassing them, not to sell them on the open market at the gun show at the old Best building on Sheridan and 290 here in Austin, but no, to invade and conquer Waco and fight Armageddon or whatever crap, you know? But that wasn't even true about him. But then, what the congressmen were supposed to buy from this cop was that everybody that the cops deal with out there are all a bunch of David Koresh's. Their definition of Koresh, the madman, lunatic, psychopath Charles Manson with the AK-47 and an army of whatever, you know, their worst smear of Koresh and his people. That's who we all are. That every attempt to serve a warrant is likely to be met with an ambush by insane cultists who are going to machine gun us all down. When, of course, the truth is, they could have sent a couple of cops in three-piece suits to knock on Koresh's door and everything would have been fine. That's the joke, right? It was the ATF's military-style raid that was nothing but a publicity stunt, and them firing first, including shooting Koresh himself and his father-in-law in their first volley of shots, when he was saying, quote, "Stop! There's women and children!" And they shot him in the stomach. Well, whatever, in the abdomen somewhere. Anyway, that became this huge precedent that every warrant must be served by police who are ready for anything. Otherwise, they could end up like the four ATF martyrs of February 28th, ambushed by that insane terrorist cult and blah, blah, blah. And somehow, that passed. That was okay. People nodded confidently and said, yes, that is the proper conclusion from this event. Let every sheriff's department be armed up and trained like their Navy SEALs, like their Delta Force, speaking of Waco, like their Delta Force special forces whose job it is to explode people to death. Kick people's doors in at 3 and 4 in the morning. Well, Sonny, back in my day, this is what they taught me when I was a kid, what it was like in the Soviet Union. They come for you in the middle of the night. That's the definition of the tyranny of the East German Stasi, of the Soviet NKVD. They come in, or before them, the German, well, and during them, the German Gestapo. They come for you in the middle of the night and take you away, and that's if you survive it. You know, the initial abduction. It's completely out of control. And you know how these cops are, man. You know, especially if you're a male out there, they're just like you were when you were 11 or 12 or whatever. You know, your friend gets away with something, you want to get away with it too, kind of mentality. And that's why in that video I posted 10 times yesterday, trying to get people to pay attention for a moment to retweet it, the one that Will Grigg mentioned on the show, where the cops in Michigan line up like a firing squad and execute this homeless guy. You can find it at libertycrier.com. And they shoot 45 times. They only hit him 14 times, obviously killing him, riddling him with bullets. But that's how many shots went wild, too. 36 shots went wild, right? Hit him 14 times. But it could have just been, I saw in the YouTube comments, it could have just been one cop shoots him once. But as soon as one cop pulls the trigger at all, they all just open fire, empty their guns at him. This is their chance to kill somebody, and they're not going to let it pass. Simple as that. They want to kill somebody. That's why they became cops. Hey, all Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Live in La Vida Baroca, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Live in La Vida Baroca by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Matthew Ho. He is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and is the former director of the Afghanistan Study Group, a network of foreign and public policy experts and professionals advocating for a change in U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. He was a Marine in Iraq and then a State Department weenie in Afghanistan, and now he's writing for the Huffington Post. Welcome back to the show, Matthew. How are you doing?
Good, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. Well, let me make sure I got you up loud enough here. Yeah, it should be fine. Hey, so very interesting article here. It seems like when you write stuff, you're writing stuff that other people, they're not really looking at what you're looking at. But I am, and you're making a very important point here, at least to start. It's a great place to start this conversation, and that is the war crimes of the good guys in the Iraq War, the side that America is taking, once again, the side of the Iranian-backed Shiite militias.
Correct. You know, and that's, I think, something that everyone needs to understand with this conflict in Iraq, but this pertains to many, many other conflicts, probably 99% of conflicts, that there are no good guys, that there are two sides or multiple sides who are fighting for the benefit of a few, either for financial or territorial or just strictly power reasons, or maybe for ideological or religious reasons, but that there are rarely ever a good side. Rarely ever is there a side with who are wearing white hats. And you see that very clearly in the conflicts in Syria and Iraq, that what is motivating most of the people to fight, whether they're fighting on behalf of the Islamic State, whether they're fighting on behalf of Sunni tribes, whether they're fighting on behalf of the Kurdish forces or on Bashar Assad's forces, under Iraqi government's forces, is to protect their own population, their own people from the other side. And that's what makes these civil wars so particularly nasty, and that why this cycle of violence It is so easy to spin out of control and create Frankensteins like you see with the Islamic State, because, like I said, there are no good guys. And when there are no good guys, everybody is fighting to protect themselves. And this report from Amnesty International that came out earlier this month, you know, clearly shows that as bad as the Islamic State is, in many ways, the Iraqi government is just as bad.
Yeah, I think. And this has been part of a problem of the whole war, is that they've never, well, nowadays they talk a little bit about the factions on TV, but they've got no background, because in the whole second Iraq war, they never stopped and said, here's the Dawah Party, here's the Supreme Islamic Council, here's Muqtada al-Sadr, and here are the different Sunni factions, and here are the different Kurdish factions, and, you know, why are they fighting and any of these things. They never explained all that. They always just, well, you know, it's us and the Iraqi people versus the terrorists and whatever crap. And, you know, they never really explain what the hell is the Badr Brigade anyway. And so now they're kind of starting fresh, but without the history. And of course, for anybody who was paying attention, and you had to pay close attention then, or I guess lived through it like you did, who knows who the Badr Brigade are, they know that they don't have any more claim on moral legitimacy than ISIS. And that's in the middle of ISIS machine gunning their prisoners to death and crucifying them upside down and enslaving and raping and killing women and children. Badr Brigade are no better men than them.
Exactly. And that is what needs to be understood, what has to be understood, if we're going to prevent future conflicts. I get discouraged with these conflicts, because I think once the fighting has been joined, once the cycle of violence has began, it has to peter out on its own. And of course, accelerants can occur, such as outside powers or outside forces getting involved and providing money and weapons or training or encouragement or legitimacy, as we often do, or starting in the first place, as we often do. But the key to understanding this, you know, and preventing future conflicts, is understanding that there are no good guys in these situations. And that's the average people who are being hurt, who are being destroyed, who are suffering from other groups, and that it cuts across all these groups. So it is just one broad swath of suffering with these various groups leading the fighting that have no moral legitimacy, have no reason for their actions, other for their own personal gain.
Yeah, you know, if you could do me a favor, I think if you possibly turn your speakers down on your computer just a little bit, or maybe it's the mic. I think it's the speakers causing a little bit of feedback there. Skype problems. I could write a book called Skype Problems. I was going to say, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but it's just a point of agreement with you. Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA, has been lauding it. I mean, I talked with him all about this, but most notably, I think, was what he told Lou Dobbs on Fox News when Lou Dobbs said, well, geez, so what are you saying? Because he was talking about the absurdity of backing the rebels in Syria. And Lou Dobbs said, well, so should we back Assad? And Scheuer is the type who, is very much for killing the enemy. He's not squeamish about that whatsoever. Very kind of conservative nationalist on those grounds. And so purely for pragmatic reasons, he said, no, we should not back Assad. We should have never backed the rebels against him, which was insanity. But to back him is just as bad, basically, because then you're outright allying with their sectarian enemies in a way that just reinforces their position better and makes them makes their propaganda that they're the defenders of the true faith from all these different apostates aligned with the Christians from across the sea, which only makes them more powerful.
You know, absolutely. You know, and you got to put yourself, you know, I saw CNN had a photo today of a grieving Kurdish mother in northern Syria. And the photo was of her son who looked like he was probably in his early 20s who had been killed a couple months ago in the fighting. And any one of us who, you know, both you and I, Scott, if we lived in northern Syria, would be fighting ISIS. Just in the same vein, if we were living in the Sunni parts of Iraq or the Sunni parts of Syria, would more than likely maybe not be a part per se of the Islamic State, but we would be supportive of them to a certain extent because that's in the interests of our own survival and the survival of our families. And that's what I think, again, the point that people have to grasp here is this desperation that fuels this cycle of violence and how, as you just commented with and Michael Scheuer is a great example because, as you said, he's not squeamish about killing people. It's not a question of being tough or being able to kill. It's a question of being smart about it and understanding what is the causes of these conflicts and why does the conflict keep growing? Why does it keep building? Why does it keep spiraling? And when you understand that, it's because these are civil wars that are pitting one ethnicity or sect against the other and basically threatening each other with annihilation. Well, then how does it not escalate? You know, if the Islamic State is approaching your Kurdish village, how do the Kurds not fight? And how does the Sunnis not support the Islamic State when Shia troops are moving on their village? And then you get into retribution of it, right? So you sacked, you burned, you raped my people. I'm going to do the same to you.
Let me ask you this. Now, Matthew, do you think that Obama and them believe their own hype when they talk about, well, we've got to help the Iraqis fight these guys? I mean, I fear a lot of times they believe their own propaganda, their own oversimplifications, that they don't even want to admit the sectarian nature, really, of the fight in their plan. That they just sort of look at ISIS like it's this alien force that came, you know, from outer space or from over some border somewhere, never mind, and grafted itself on when they had to have the agreement of a great many Sunnis, as you're describing. And, of course, I can't let you answer now because the music's playing and we got to go to break. But we'll be right back with Matthew Ho in just a sec, y'all. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I think someone tried to hijack my Twitter account, and now it's suspended. I'm going to have to work on that. That's another thing I got to do today. All right. I'm wasting time. I'm talking with Matthew Ho, and former Marine and State Department and critic of Iraq and Afghan war policy, a writer at HuffingtonPost.com. The latest is, with America's help, Iraq's cycle of violence spirals. So a couple of references now, the last war and this one, to the narrative as told by the state and for the most part the media, Matthew, about how, yeah, it's us and the people of Iraq versus the bad guy terrorists who are doing the bad things that make us have to fight them. And I would guess that a lot of the bad decisions made in the last war were based because they at least had to pretend to believe that while they were doing some of the horrible things that they did, like hiring the Bada Brigade and the El Salvador option to create the damn civil war in the first place. But then I hear them talking about the situation in Iraq that way now, as though the Islamic State doesn't really exist, as though Sunnistan has not really declared independence, as though Baghdad is still really the capital of all of Iraq, and this is just a short-term aberration, and it's still us and the Iraqis versus the terrorists, and not much further identification for, you know, what they're about than that. So anyway, what do you think about that? And I'm sorry I'm asking you to describe what you think they think, but I really wonder what you think they think they're doing over there.
You know, I really do believe with the Bush administration in 2003 that they really thought they were going to change the Middle East, that they really thought that they were going to make these pliant, Western-friendly democracies that were going to follow their lead. And they really thought that they really believed in themselves and their power to change history and their power to change peoples. With this administration, I think it's much more cynical. I think some of them do believe, because when you lie continuously, ultimately you believe the lies. Some of it I think is just naive. Some of it is just straight political necessity. It's better for a black Democrat to be tough and bomb people than to face the political suggestion that he's not tough or that he's weak. And then, frankly, a lot of it is they just don't know what they're doing. They're receiving bad advice. They're taking advice from people who are either profiting from the wars, in this case of, say, think tanks that are funded by the defense industry, or from people who have been involved in these campaigns from the start and who cannot split themselves, their personal legacy and their careers from the actual policies. So I think it's a mix of things, but none of it is quite any good. And I think when you speak to these people in Washington in both administrations, particularly say in the National Security Council, their lack of understanding, their lack of appreciation for what life is really like in the midst of those wars, for who is actually on the different sides, for what our quote unquote allies are actually like, who actually comprises our enemies, is often turned upside down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a huge part of this is, you know, the anti-Assad politics of the Israel lobby, and for that matter, the Israeli state and the Saudi one, too, and all of that pressure when at least, you know, like Scheuer was saying, at least, you know, stopping financing and supporting his opponents would make sense, you know. Allow him to go ahead and fight, but it's domestic politics that dictates an exactly completely wrong-headed strategy for what's actually going on over there.
And the refusal to acknowledge a mistake. You know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you cannot acknowledge any mistake. You cannot, you know, and this goes, you know, I'm a big, one of the most important books I've ever read was David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest. And that describes the Kennedy and the Johnson administrations, you know, continual buildup in Vietnam and decision-making involved in that, as well as Bill Moyer's wrote an excellent piece about 5 years ago on his own personal view of Johnson making that decision to escalate the war in Vietnam. And you see, just as now, his choices are all – his choices were binded in, were bound in by domestic political concerns. He has to go fight the Vietnamese. He has to go fight the communists. He has to fight the Reds, or else how can he stare down these senators who are going to go after him? And the same thing, too, I think, with the Obama administration, you see the same thing. If we don't bomb, then we're going to have John McCain and Lindsey Graham on Sunday morning television shows coming after us. And I think that has as much of a calculus and as much of a determinant in making the policy as does anything else. But again, there are a lot of things involved in these policies. You can't not acknowledge the fact that we didn't really care too much about the Islamic State beheading people until they started to threaten the Kurdish oil fields. I mean, so there's a lot of things that go into this as well, besides just the domestic politics. It's just that at that senior level, at the level of the chief executive, the domestic politics trumps everything. And then, of course, when he's looking for an explanation or a reason to do something, there are all types of people who have purposes and desires and who will benefit from such from the war policies, who he can turn to give him strategy and give him reasons and give him excuses. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's certainly interesting to see the competing interests between something must be done here when you have more or less a bin Laden incarnate there preaching, claiming autocracy or whatever from the balcony in Mosul like that, and all the pressure to undo that for a regime change in Mosul as fast as possible. You can't let this guy continue to let himself call himself Caliph Ibrahim and all his crap for any kind of long period of time. On the other hand, they really recognize that the American people, they really don't care about that ultimately, and they are really against sending troops back over there to undo it. And so, I don't know how they're going to handle this. I'm sure it'll get much worse after the midterm elections are over here in a little while. But those are some pretty severe competing interests when Baghdadi is 10 times what they ever accused Saddam of being falsely. Yeah. And yet the American people's answer is, yeah, we already let you go invade Iraq to get rid of the terrorists, and we're not going to let you do that again. Send drones, maybe, but not our boys.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it is. It's the government squandered whatever trust the public had in them to commit American troops by going after Saddam Hussein. And then to make it even more of a tragedy, that failure resulted in Baghdadi, right? That failure resulted in the Islamic State. And I think that is a lesson that we must continue to take from this. Is that our meddling overseas, our intervention, our trying to play risk with real live dictators and real live countries fails. And when it fails, you get Frankensteins like the Islamic State. And so that's really what is the lesson of this. And there may not be a lot we can do in Iraq or Syria besides making it worse. So the thing we must look at then is how do we prevent ourselves from creating these Frankensteins again, from unleashing these types of forces, this dynamic, these cycles of violence?
Yeah. Well, now, so try to say it quickly. My thumbnail assessment here is that the Islamic State is surrounded by enemies. They're landlocked. They only have black market trading partners. They'll never have an open diplomatic relationship with any of the neighboring states. America can surely prevent anything like that from taking place. And of course, these guys are such horrible bastards in the way that they operate. And we've seen how the Iraqi people, treat their kind, seen them in the past. They were driven to ally with Al-Qaeda in Iraq out of desperation back in 05 and 06 and 07. And then they turned on them and said, actually, this is our land, not yours, and screw you. Now, I know Baghdadi and his top people mostly are Iraqis, but still, that's not typically their system. It hasn't been for a long time to live in an Islamist state like that. So my theory is just do absolutely nothing is the shortest distance between here and the fall of the caliph. But I wonder if you think that's just my kind of own confirmation bias there, or you think that may be right.
I agree. And I agree with your assessment. The one thing I would say that twerks that assessment a bit is if you look at, say, the Taliban, very similar prior to 9/11 in Afghanistan, and what kept them in power and what was the main cause, in my opinion, of their rapid demise was the Pakistani government. And in 2001, after 9/11, when we invaded Afghanistan, the Pakistanis pulled their support, their over support for the Afghan Taliban. You saw how quickly they crumbled once they stopped receiving Pakistani rupees. The same thing I believe in Islamic State will occur if you get the Saudis and the Qataris and the other Gulf states to stop supporting them. Because I agree with your assessment. They're surrounded by enemies. They have no market. They have no economy. And they're a terrible, horrible organization that will fail as long as they're not propped up from the outside. So we should do nothing, and we should ensure that in the same way that we're not, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink to the Saudis and the Qataris to continue supporting them.
Yeah, the Turks. And really, you know, I don't know exactly how much influence they have, but it seems like if the American government was really serious, no, I'm really serious, stop financing these guys, I mean it, they would stop, right? They've had a wink and a nudge this whole time at least, haven't they?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that's the whole thing, will it? But, you know, and this is stuff we can get into when you start getting into the relationship between the Saudi royal family and our political leadership and the Saudi royal family and our CIA director. You know, you wonder about those things. Would they actually do it? You know, so.
Yep. Well, and the Israelis have made it clear all along, too, that they prefer at least unending low-level warfare, if not outright regime change in Damascus. So
absolutely.
Yeah. I stated that on the record. And that's, you know, they were, I think, pushing a lot harder than the Saudis a year ago for the airstrikes against Assad under the chemical weapons scam there. All right. Well, anyway, I've kept you over time, but thanks very much for your time. Good to talk to you again, Matthew.
You bet, Scott. You have a good one.
Appreciate you, too.